news I gained just yesterday dismayed all that I learned. The emptiness of life examined, time can't be returned.
Well, hello out there, and welcome to another episode of Things I Learned While Learning Other Things. This is an attempt by me, Joe Morahan, and my brother J.S., to provide you with a series of interesting, informative, educational, and yeah, we hope enjoyable stories that will help you navigate through those high seas of life. Today we return to the story of Glenn Frey. And I got to tell you, if you've been listening to our recent episodes, you will remember that in May, it will be the 100th anniversary, monthly anniversary, of the death of Glenn Frey. I can't believe 12% or so of my life has gone by since Glenn Frey died. Obviously, I was an Eagle song, and this man was a balladeer. He was a singer-songwriter of the highest order. And it's really hard to imagine that he left us at the young age, the relatively young age of 67. So we return to our story entitled Already Gone. This is Glenn Frey, Part 5. So between 1972 and 1980, the Eagles could rightfully claim that they had secured every objective they'd set out to accomplish, to achieve, but for the acclaim of critics. That would be denied them. They had numerous hit songs, platinum albums, they had fans across the globe, they sold out arenas, they had lots of money, they traveled by private jet, you know, they stayed in luxurious hotel suites wherever they played. And oh yeah, remember all those boyhood dreams, always plenty of beautiful, adoring young women to be around? Yeah, those dreams came true too. And those beautiful young women, it is truly amazing just how many of those young, beautiful, attractive women were ready, willing, and able to lend a hand or two if necessary, and other more delicate parts of their anatomy to ensure those Eagles' dreams came to fruition. Extending till late into the early morning hours, the band's third encore, that special 3E exclusive with passes issued to only attractive, eager young girls spotted in the audience, you know, and to be invited to those post-concert private Eagles parties, they were remembered most fondly by the band members as having been, beyond doubt, nothing less than eye-opening, eye-watering experiences. Of that, we can conclude. And let's just say that a great deal of fun was had all around. By the way, the women sharing their individualistic, idiosyncratic, unique, signature, delicate, and most varied delights with Hungry Eagles band members until the prearranged, by the band members, the bewitching hour had come about. At which point, per prior agreement, you know, arranged with the band's crew, it remained to the attending road crew to do their duty and clear the hotel suites of all those lovely female partygoers at that agreed upon bewitching hour. Ladies, party's over, girls. You're out of here. Time to go. Band rules. Sorry, no exception. It wasn't necessarily an easy job, as easy a job as might be expected. I mean, some of the most attentive of these girls assumed that their vigorous exertions, full commitment to the pleasure that night at the party had earned them the right to stay the night with those boys of summer. But alas, that was not to be the case. No matter the degree of their exertions, you know, so recently displayed, you know, their demonstrative willingness to participate in all that fun, nor their recently demonstrated skills, if you will, warranted a sleepover with the boys in the band. This wasn't Michael Jackson's Neverland. It wasn't happening. You know, more often than one might possibly imagine, it could be an ugly scene, an ugly job, as some of these women were outright shocked at the inhospitality that was shown them. They were angered, bewildered, stunned, and many thought themselves unfairly treated. Turned out, suddenly, without prior warning, to be shuffled out without prior notice out of the Eagles' presidential suites. When they learned they were being unceremoniously ushered out without exception, some of the women were quite dismayed. Well, let's just call it pissed off. Righteous indignation? You bet your ass. I mean, and it's tough being a roadie, forced to deal with all these disappointed, upset, young, vigorous women. But hey, rules were rules, weren't they? And they had been established by the band. And why were the girls, why were these women upset? Well, because they'd come to love the guys in just a few short hours in which they'd been so intimate with each other, together. I mean, wasn't that a love to be returned, appreciated? I mean, love, what's love got to do with it? I mean, that would be the Eagles' response. Sure, the band loved those girls in their own way, though. A love that surely resembled the love, along the lines that love was made so famous by no less a figure than Ronnie Woods of the Stones, than the love that he had for Margaret Trudeau. The nature of that love was, that love, let's actually paraphrase Ronnie Woods' actual statement to the assembled Canadian press when they eagerly and doggedly pressed him so hard about his rumored relationship with Margaret Trudeau, that 29 years younger than her husband, who is then no less than the Canadian Prime Minister, Pierre Trudeau. And Ronnie Woods, a hardcore Brit, down to the bone, a man whom survived 19 stints in rehab. I mean, he was no quitter. That Ronnie Woods, he had some staying power, that is for sure. As Keith Richards, once had reminded Ronnie by telex while Ronnie was in, one of those rehab stints, rehab is for quitters, Ronnie. And Ronnie, he was anything but a quitter. And Ronnie as well had a deep-rooted understanding of the meaning of chivalric duties attendant to all honorable knights. A line of code, of that code entailed it, that it was never gentlemanly, never worthy of a knight to kiss and tell. And Ronnie understood the demands of respect to a lady, especially a first lady. And he took pains to display his diplomacy and was especially sensitive in matters when they involved a head of state and their wives. I mean, recognizing that he and fellow Stones were guests of the nation, in this case, the nation of Canada, Ronnie carefully worded his answer, delicately, actually, as respects Margaret Trudeau. He said, even though our relationship lasted only a few moments, it had been very special. Oh, yeah, I'm sure it was, Ronnie. And I think every reporter in that room on that night, male or female, got a very clear picture as to exactly what the nature of that relationship between Margaret and Ronnie might have been, and just why it had been so special, and what it might have looked like from, say, ground level. Years later, American political reporter and journalist Nina Burley, she later imagined, she spelled out quite pictorially, actually, just what such a special relationship might look like, that she could envision taking place between herself and President Bill Clinton as a reward for all that Bill Clinton had done for women in the USA. Might imagine, several truths might have come to the fore in the mind of Hillary Clinton. I mean, I can't seem to do an episode or a podcast without mentioning Hillary Clinton. She's been such an important part of my life. But in any event, Hillary Clinton might have had some deep-rooted thoughts about Nina Burley's remarks, you know, spelling out Nina's willingness to get down on her presidential knee pads to thank the president of the United States on behalf of all American women for all he'd done to benefit American women, the cause of the American woman. And it's unlikely that Hillary Clinton ever had known, nor had ever borrowed a pair of presidential knee pads in her life. Of that, I'm pretty sure. Owned or borrowed, they'd forever remain unused, though. If Bill ever harbored the delusion he might ever see Hillary adorned in presidential knee pads, he was sadly delusional for sure. Big sloppy thank yous for all her husband had done to benefit American women in recent years. If ever would, it would never be on the menu. Of that, Hillary was certain. Apparently, history would mount. We're talking about Margaret Trudeau again. And apparently she demonstrated that as the years flew by, she loved to engage in these kinds of special relationships with more than a fair number of well-known celebrity rock stars. It was just her thing. And such relationships are the nature that Margaret Trudeau was often rumored to have been involved in, were memorialized forevermore, in my opinion, by London's Fleet Street Press, you know, the tabloid press, for reasons, you know, maybe I'll explain another day, but such relationships were referred to by Fleet Street writers in a well-understood street jargon, you know, code, as having been of such nature that they qualified as Ugandan relations. Okay. Margaret Trudeau was not one of the notorious plaster casters that Frank Zappa of the Mothers of Invention would help make so famous, perhaps. But rumors were that Margaret collected so many celebrity heads such that she might have made even the Dayak people, those feared tattooed headhunters of Borneo, insanely jealous. Yes, that was Margaret Trudeau. So anyway, I seem to have lost the thread. So let's return to the Eagles and the band members themselves. As they rock and rolled through the 1970s, they struggled to keep pace with events. To a man, they were exhausted and spent. And there's no doubt that life as a rock star, as we know them to be, that it's a difficult life, what with all those obligations to the fan base, the need to rehearse, to perform on stage, the long hours spent in the recording studio, the pressure, the ever-growing pressure to release ever more hit songs and albums. It's hard, man, very hard, and it's draining. And beyond all that obligatory partying, all the energy expended in living up to, fulfilling, if not exceeding, the rampant sexual performance expectations of women groupies of their rock stars, they can't be imagined no less fulfilled. I mean, such efforts just suck the life out of any man. And so it happened to the Eagles. Because life on the road can be such a bitch. Alcohol and drugs may have amped up their music, fueled all the fun as they chased success very hard. But then at some point, no doubt, the worm turns. And as often proved the case with boys in any band, they eventually find themselves chasing the drugs. In a takeoff from a line from the 19th century French author, the novelist Honoré de Balzac, the more they talked about honor, the faster I counted my spoons. The band was unraveling as quickly Something definitely had disappeared somewhere along the way, and it was only a matter of time now before all hell might break loose. And the band, the Eagles, despite massive talents, creative genius, and incredible work ethic, under intense strain and pressure, the Eagles were disintegrating. Drug and alcohol reliance made a bad situation infinitely worse. Creative differences of the band members rose. And, you know, the physical and emotional toll due to their lifestyle had driven the band right to the edge of the cliff. And if you've ever been to, say, the cliffs of Moher on the west coast of Ireland, you'll understand just how steep a fall that would be to fall from the cliffs of Moher. To tumble over that edge, it's fatal, man. There are no minor injuries. There are not even any major injuries. One is simply dead. And the ever relentless demands of record label executives for more and more product, more and more superior work product, it just ratcheted up the heat in the studio to pressure cooker levels. Something had to give. And it would. Progress slowed to a crawl on new songs. You know, the creative differences and tensions that once had been a source for, you know, positive, imaginative breakthroughs, now amped up by that growing retreat to a reliance on drugs and alcohol, served only to ramp up unproductive disputes. No progress was being made. There were flare-ups, temper tantrums, and it led to walkouts from the studio of pissed-off, furious band members, thereby stymieing any thought of making progress whatsoever on their songs. It could not elicit any sort of harmony. The recording of the album, you know, aptly titled The Long Run, was extraordinarily protracted. Previously, I mean, it's unimaginable for the band. The Eagles entered their studio in 1978. The Long Run album took more than 18 months to finish. It was recorded in 5 different studios, and it wasn't officially released until September 1979. Not only was the album finished, the band was finished. Yet, despite their monumental personal problems with each other, you know, creative differences, distractions, false starts, delays, you know, dry spells, in testament to their unbelievable abilities, the album that they produced, nevertheless, had 3 memorable hit songs included: Heartache Tonight, The Long Run, and I Can't Tell You Why. And by the way, all those song titles seemingly were each emblematic of the chaotic experience it had been to record them. And as the album hit the streets to great reviews, so did Glenn Frey. He walked out of the studio, and he did not return for 14 years. There had been no final slugfest among the band members, no final knockdown, no final showdown. There was no last confrontation. There were no ultimatums ever issued. You know, it was like running back Barry Sanders of Fry's, you know, Detroit Lions. You know, season concluded, running back Barry Sanders just never returned to the team. I guess Barry was done. Did he retire? Well, is he ever coming back? What's up with that? Barry knew he was done. It's just that his teammates, they didn't know if he was done. They didn't even know where he was. In Barry's case, he never came back. Ever. He just, you know, walked away, Renee, if you know what I mean. Well, I mean, and there is so much more to the story, as most of you know. And we'll cover the divorce, if you will, of the Eagles, that painful separation. You know, discussion of the drugs and alcohol and the arrests and the achievements that will follow. You know, the hell freezes over moments, you know, that followed. And we'll cover this in our next podcast. Whew, I'm exhausted. Hey, thanks for listening. It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
the harbor, head out to the sea. Crystal blue water surrounding me. Tap to the wind, taste the sea breeze. Tropical heaven on the coral sea. A little more rum, I think of my wife. What did I do? Have I ruined my life? Tell her I've changed, become a new man. I promise I will, and I know that I can. When did the skies change? When did they turn black? How am I ever gonna get myself back? The sea's now boiling and I'm getting cold. I've lost my sails, got to find a way home. Alone in my boat, I think of my wife. I'm lost in a drift on the high seas of life. Years from tomorrow, days from the land. Nothing can save me unless fate lends a hand. Storm, it is worse than I know. The wind and the waves are taking their toll. I look to the stars, there's none I can see. I'm afraid fate, she has answered me. Only moments my story will end. There was a story I wanted to send. Oh, how I dream for the calm of the sea. Face smiling back at me. The sea is boiling and I'm getting cold. I've lost my sails, got to find a way home. When did the skies change? When did they turn black? How am I ever gonna get myself back? Alone in my boat, I think of my wife. I'm lost in a drift on the high seas of life. When did the skies change? When did they turn black? How am I ever gonna get myself back? Alone in my boat, I think of my wife. I'm lost in a drift on the high seas.